But you probably didn't come here to see me. So it is my pleasure to welcome you to today's event and introduce you to two very special people. The first is the Dean of the Mumaw College of Business, who over the last 5 years has led the college to both national and global spotlights on numerous fronts, from marketing to accounting to information systems. His vision includes infusing data analytics and creativity into each major to prepare graduates like me to enter into the changing, complex business world. He's going to lead today's conversation, so please help me welcome one of our very own, Dean Moez Lemayum. Our guest of honor is no stranger to analytics and technology and creativity. He is an entrepreneur, a philanthropist, and an engineer. He was a co-founder of Apple and the inventor of the Apple computer that sparked a revolution. That computer was the first step on a path that has led to devices being found in every home, briefcase, backpack, and hip pocket of users across the known universe. For him, thinking outside the box and taking chances are daily exercises. How else can you explain to me seeing an engineer and an inventor getting up in front of millions of people with a pink feather boa on Dancing with the Stars and dancing the Argentinian tango? Ladies and gentlemen, please give a real USF welcome for a genius who truly changed forever the way humans around the globe conduct business and live their lives. Please welcome Steve the Woz Wozniak.
Welcome.
All right, good afternoon. Now we can do better than that. Let's repeat again. Good afternoon. Much better. What a great day at USF. What a great day at the Mumaw College of Business. We're just delighted, very happy, very excited to have you here. You know, today we're making history at USF. And we're making history at the Mumaw College of Business. One day you will all say, we've been there. This is for the very first time USF and the Mumaw College of Business is starting the Thought Leadership Series Award. So this is the first one. You always will tell your kids and all the others, we've been there. And we could not have found a better audience and a great award winner for the Thought Leadership than the one and only the Woz. Let's try to give him a very welcome from USF, and thank you. We're delighted you're here, Woz. We really are. And you know, you are the best thought leader we've ever had.
I'm amazed at how many people are here, but I think if it was a sports event in Florida, I'd be full.
That's great. Before we even start, there are everybody's very special here, but there are some extra special few people that truly invested very transformationally in the Mumaw College of Business and helped us improve the lives of our students for generations to come. And of course, Pam and Les Mumaw, who helped us name the Mumaw College of Business and establish it one of the best in the world. Les and Pam, please. Thank you. And also, Ms. Lynn Pippinger, who helped us name the only school of accountancy in the world named solely by women. So we have the Lynn Pippinger School of Accountancy. And the beautiful, beautiful Lynn Pippinger Hall at USF St. Pete. Lynn, thank you so much. And we have so many great supporters here and colleagues and leadership, so we're very grateful you're here. Vilas, our students, was right. I am the dean of the best college of business in the world, the Mumaw College of Business. And we want to make sure that you are also engaged. we will be accepting Twitter questions, and Dr. Balaji Padmanabhan will take your questions, and sometimes we will go to the questions there too.
Yeah. And yes, we got many great tweets already, and some sent questions on email, and I think the reason they sent it on email is that if the question sounds silly, they can always blame the moderator.
Okay, good. and also, I think we tried to convince the WAS, if your question is selected from the Twitter, you can dance with the WAS on stage. Right, WAS? All right, very good. So, let's... what I want to do first, we want to get to know you a little bit better.
Yeah. Well, you told me backstage that the Twitter winners would get a Ferrari.
No, that's actually, thank you for mentioning. So we also have something very creative. You know what this? It's a fishbowl. And we asked our students and some of the friends of USF and MUMA, we said, if you want to ask the WAS one question, what would it be? And we put these questions here, of course. We deleted some of the questions that we cannot discuss in a general audience. And if your question be pulled, you will have the key to a Ferrari. You still have to buy the Ferrari. All right, WAS,
okay.
I'm gonna ask you few questions, and you have to select between two things, very quickly. Star Trek or Star Wars?
My son or my daughter? I can't really take a side.
Okay, all right. Everybody. Books or movies?
Books. Books are always better when you see both. Sometimes they're similar, but sometimes the book is so much different.
All right.
Better.
Space Invaders or Pong?
Man, Pong started things. It's very hard to start something new, figure out a technique to do it. And Space Invaders was a better game, but I'm going to pick Pong for being original.
All right. We will not tell the people. Bruno or Carrie Ann?
Bruno.
Bruno, all right.
Personality, good. Just like yours.
Okay, please don't tell Carrie Ann, okay? I've done some research. You like pranks, don't you?
All my life has been very much pranks and a lot of telling jokes and making jokes up. Making jokes up is creativity. You're making them out of nothing. That's... and how can you fool people? Yeah.
So which best prank you can share with us?
I get asked that a lot, and I've done so many hundreds of pranks, and I do them all the time, and I can't really pick best ones. I could pick a few major ones. I mean, some of them actually took a month of time and a lot of money and work and were really great pranks. I liked some of the pranks I liked were where I made it seem like I framed someone else, made it look like someone else had done it. Very well-constructed ones, and I've done that a few times. I made it look like in my first year of college, Introduction to Computers was a graduate-level course, and I was a freshman. I got an A-plus in the course, but I took a little TV jammer I built. I was a ham radio operator, built a little TV jammer, because two-thirds of us watched it on four TVs in a different classroom than the professor, and I made them kind of jammed up a little bit. You know, you could still watch the TV, and three TAs stood up looking us over, turn off the transmitter. No, I wasn't going to reach over. It was in a magic marker pen. I wasn't going to get caught for that. So I waited till near the end of class. A guy next to the TV that was jammed the worst on the right side started walking towards, he collected his books up early. As he's walking towards the door, I made the TVs go in and out, and he left the room, and the TVs were perfect. The TA pointed at him and said, there he goes.
All right.
But I did other ones. Even when we introduced the Apple II computer, if you read my book, I was.
Let me tell you, WAS, a couple of nights ago, I had with my team, the scare of our lives. They were following you through your journey to Tampa, and they called me very late at night and said, Moez, we might have a problem. I said, what is the problem? Said, the WAS is landing in San Francisco. We think that he took USF for the University of San Francisco. But we're so happy at the original USF, the University of South Florida. All right, very good. So I'm sure everyone wants to know how it all started. You, Steve Jobs, and the garage.
Yes. It's such a long story, and it started when I was 9 years old, and what was Steve? Maybe 5 years old. And I just learned computer technology and logic and ones and zeros. There were no books anywhere. You couldn't learn it on, I stumbled into a journal here and there, and I said, this is what I'm gonna love for the rest of my life. Didn't think of it as a job. I didn't even think of it as engineering. Engineering, I was a ham radio operator back then when I was 10 years old, and that was how you hook up all these parts and do the mathematics and make things work and radios, the old day, engineering. I didn't think computers were engineering. Computers were in these weird places called research, you know, or factories or companies or military. So, but anyway, as I progressed through, I did all these science fair projects that won huge awards. I would be in eighth grade and I'd win the award for a Bay Area Science Fair all the way up to 12th graders in electronics. So I was one of those premier people. I'd never have to worry about a job coming out of high school. I was just so advanced in both analog electronics and the digital stuff I taught myself. By high school, I saw a manual that described the insides of a computer, the architecture, and I said, I wonder if I went back to my elementary school science fair projects with these little things called logic gates that I learned to build out of transistors. Could I design, maybe using chips, could I design a computer? And it took months at first. You worked and you worked and you worked and you don't know how to do it. You figure it out. No books told me how to do it. So by the end of high school, I was every weekend, I would go in and get a manual for a new computer, IBM, Varian, Hewlett Packard, and I would design it. And I got to where I could design any computer in the world in about 2 days. There were some complicated computers that would take more. And I just did it. I didn't think I'd ever have a job in designing computers. And then, of course, went through college. And I told my dad, like my first year of college, I am someday going to own a 4K mini computer. Why 4K bytes? Seems small now, but that was the minimum you needed to type in programs, to solve puzzles, to solve games, to solve problems. What I love to do with computers, 4K, my dad said it cost as much as a house. And with the input output. And I was stunned and I said, I'll live in an apartment. A goal is much more important than knowledge. I had a lot of knowledge, but a goal, I want something. And I had great jobs designing the hottest products in the world. And I would design interesting things. There were no movies in hotels yet. And a guy in Hollywood wanted to build a movie and hotel system and I got to design it. And I charged him, while I worked at Hewlett Packard, designing the hottest product of the day, the scientific calculators, I would take these side jobs and I would always charge 5 cents. That was my pay because I loved it so much. When I was in college, I would type term papers on the old school typewriters from midnight till 6:30 in the morning. I would type them for other people. Always charge 5 cents. If you love something, that's how you are to it. So I was. So here it was. I spotted when the parts got to the right price and you could build at a price a human could afford. I could afford with no money, no savings accounts in the bank, nothing like that. I could afford a computer that was useful. So of course I built it. Now Steve Jobs wasn't around. He was out of town. For about 5 years before Apple, the day I met him, I showed him all my Bob Dylan albums and the liner notes and the lyrics and all that. And we had a big fun part of our life between concerts, pranks, jokes, running around, little blue boxes that could make phone calls everywhere in the world. We had quite a life as like normal young kids, you know, young 20s or less. And Steve wasn't around. He was at a commune in Oregon. About once a year, he'd been coming into town. He would see the latest thing that I designed for fun, a little Pong game I built myself. I designed Breakout for Atari, actually. And he'd see these things, and he'd always turn them into money for us. He was the money person, because he had zero money. I had a job. He had zero money, so he had to get every little bit, the thing that I designed, he would always turn into a few hundred bucks for us. And he didn't know that I had designed this first computer. I was in a club of people that talked. We had university professors that would talk about, once we had our own computers, we would communicate so fast that you could type a message and within 1 hour, 100 people could read it. Okay. And education would be all different because you'd answer questions and get told immediately, right or wrong. Immediacy of reward and punishment is very important in psychology. If your dog poops on the floor, you don't whack it on the head by the poop 12 hours later, it doesn't learn. So that was going to be, education was going to be improved. And we little geeks who knew how to program computers would take them into our companies, type in the company financial numbers, pop out the strategies for the company. We'd be more important than the CFO just because we knew computers. I loved those. It was like a revolution. Every young person, you know, wants to somehow change things that are so wrong in the world, the government, whatever, and they want to be part of a revolution. And that was mine. It was technical. So I built this computer. I brought it down to the club, Steve wasn't around, and I gave away all the designs for free. No copyrights or anything. I wanted to help these other people to have a design that they, for $300, they could build a useful computer. And everybody looking over my shoulder saw the formula for how you build a personal computer with a keyboard, video screen, and some chips that are actually doing the video as well. That was the formula, and then Steve Jobs came into town. He came in, because he'd come in once in a while, And the movie with Ashton Kutcher shows him taking me to a computer club. That's a bunch of baloney. He'd never been to the club. I'd been there every day since it started. I was a hero at the club showing off my computer every 2 weeks. So I took him down to the club to show him what it was about, and he saw all the interest, and that's when he said, we should start a company. Well, he and I had been doing business together for 5 years. And starting the company, I had one big problem. I had made up my mind that I would be an engineer for life. Hardware, software, designing things. That was my life, and I would never move up into management. I didn't want to run things. I didn't want to get political. Didn't want to have to take sides. I just wanted to do great creative work. And I would be an engineer for life at Hewlett-Packard. Hewlett-Packard back then built the test equipment all engineers used. So we engineers were designing the stuff that we ourselves wanted. So we totally knew what was good and bad. And I loved it there, and I would never risk losing a job at Hewlett-Packard by starting another company. So I went and I proposed it to my boss and the group leader and then the section leader above him and the lab manager, they all in one big meeting, a bunch of marketing people. And I proposed it, and I got turned down for the first of 5 times. Hewlett-Packard, big companies just couldn't see any money, any revenues in this small computer as a business. They just couldn't justify it because they were smart about them. So Steve and I were in business. And our first idea, we had no money. What do you do when you're in your young 20s? You have no money. You have no business experience at all. What do? You do with what you can. And Steve's idea was not to build computers. He wasn't quite a computer person, really. It was to build this little fiberglass board called a PC board that other people could plug their chips into that they'd get from their companies or wherever, plug chips into, solder it up, and they'd be able to build my computer a lot faster than hooking up every wire themselves and cutting wires and doing all the stuff I had done to design it. So that was the idea. We'd build these boards for $20. We'd sell them for $40. We had no money. I had to sell my most valuable possession, my Hewlett-Packard 65 calculator. Steve sold a little van at home, got a few $100 to pay a guy to design the PC board. And if we sold 50, we'd make a profit. And we might not sell 50. But we'd be a company. For once in our lives, we could call ourselves a company. And that was the start of the early Apple. But Apple had 2 starts. And that start had a third person. Steve had 45%. It was a partnership. He had 45%. I had 45%. And we hired a kind of an adult guy who'd been around the block a while. He was an arch. We'd call him a libertarian today. Back then, it was different words. But he sort of had been in business, and he knew things. He was an adult, and he could answer questions. So we trusted him to resolve any disputes. Ron Wayne, but after a few weeks, he sold out his 10% of Apple for a few $100. That was the first start
He's
of Apple.
Regretting it
now we're getting up to garage. We didn't have a company in a garage, but we had a garage. When you have no money, you have to work at home. And eventually, you go out to the garage. If you're going to build things, you go in the garage. We started on the kitchen table, of course, and Steve's bedroom would stock up some boxes and things, and that's how you start. But we didn't have a company. Like, a company is like where Hewlett-Packard started in a garage. It was a famous story we told in Silicon Valley. And they had desks and workplaces and phones and manuals and everything you need in a company. All the, you know, pens and pencils and paper and all that stuff. So we were in the garage, but we only used the garage about 3 hours a week. We never did any talking about computers in the garage, never deciding what features they should have. We never did any engineering in the garage. We never did any building up, prototyping in the garage. We never did any manufacturing in the garage. Our boards were manufactured somewhere else. And eventually we got a big order, so we got chips already in the boards. We would drive them to the house once a week and out in the garage, hook them up one at a time to make sure they worked and fix the ones that needed fixing. And then Steve would get them and put them in the car and drive them down to the one computer store in the whole Silicon Valley area, the bike shop in Mountain View, and they would pay us cash. We got all the parts on 30 days credit, built up the board so fast we had no lawyers to go through and no big management to, you know, delay things. And we, within 10 days, we got paid cash for them. So we actually could build a little bank account. You know, got to sold about 100 computers or more and got the bank account up to over $10,000, just all on our own. But before we ever shipped the Apple I, we were demonstrating the product that would change the world and make a big company. The Apple I wasn't even designed by me as a computer. It was hastily modified, a terminal, to get on the early network that only had 6 computers in the United States, MIT, Stanford Research Institute, UCLA, UC Santa Barbara, and 2 others. It had 6 computers, and I could log on, and I could run programs, and I could actually read files. And I built this terminal, but it went over the phone lines. It talked to a computer far away over slow modem tones. And then when I saw the formula for building a portable computer, I hastily added the brains, a microprocessor chip that had just come out that summer, and dynamic memory, 4K bytes, that had just come out that summer, and just made it an affordable computer, but it wasn't designed as a computer to begin with. It was modified from something designed for slow operation over phone lines. So the Apple II was the real hit. And the Apple II, I put all of my expertise in the world, and I had a reputation for designing things with fewer parts than anyone else. The PhDs at Hewlett-Packard would often call our division and ask me to take one of their designs over and come up with a solution. If they had 57 transistors, I'd do it in 11. So I had that reputation for designing things very efficiently, and the Apple II, so many ideas came to my head. First of all, it was the first time ever I loved games. I loved playing games, and arcade games were just being started by Atari. They were all black and white televisions. They were all hardware designs, meaning a skilled engineer like myself could spend up to a year making a prototype that worked. Up to a year just hooking wires between chips to make signals go up and down. This was not like today, where a game is a program. You tell something to move from, you know, from 5,10 to 5,20, and it moves. The Apple II was the first time ever, well, first of all, color cost five, they didn't have any color games in the arcades. It cost $5,000 with all this heavy mathematics, differential calculus, and that kind of stuff to design special little feedback loops that treated waveforms like waves. You know, sometimes you'll see this in books, waveforms like out of the wall socket. If they're at the right speed, that would represent red. A little later in time, it would represent blue. And I was 4 days and nights without sleep because I had to design Breakout for Atari in 4 days. And so Steve could have money to move into a commune. And your mind, when you're without sleep, your mind kind of goes off like you're falling asleep or waking up. It goes, drifts off into more unchallenged areas you haven't read in a book. And all of a sudden, I realized this, if you took a number in memory, and you said you want it to appear, the number 3, you want it to appear as red on a TV, you put it into this device, it costs $5,000 of today's dollars at least. And then something popped in my head. What if these things going up and down, what if I just put ones and zeros, computer numbers, onto a wire? If I put 3 into a place in memory, and the second thing that was important was that memory would correspond to a pixel on the TV, a position on the TV. And if I store in computers, you can always say, store something in location 101, store something in location 102. If all those locations were pixels on the TV set, I realized if I took a number, a little 4 little ones and zeros, that's 16 possible numbers, and fed that number on a wire to the TV, the way TVs were designed, they would think it was color. Totally illegal. Never mentioned it. Any
Balaji,
book
think,
of engineering.
I think your iPhone is exploding.
One last comment. The Apple II was the first time ever that arcade games would be color, and the first time ever that they would be software, where a 9-year-old kid could write a program to say vertical equals 1, vertical equals 2, vertical equals 3, and make colors move on a screen.
Yeah, but I think
that's a big step for games.
We've learned something.
And you had to have games. Nobody would buy a computer in the home for inventory levels and sales figures and salaries. No, they had to have fun.
Never ask an engineer how to program a computer.
Yeah. I think when when Moez said my iPhone is exploding, he meant with tweets, not because of any battery problems.
No, the tweets.
I just
want
to make sure.
Yes.
Now we had two.
I understood.
We had two tweets about advice, you know, of different kinds. Yeah. I think the first one, and there were many on the same theme, but the first one is interesting. What advice now would you give yourself when you were 20 years old? And you know, before you respond, I think this will also be very useful for many 20-year-olds here right now who are looking for similar kinds of information. The 20-year-olds like our dean and myself, for instance.
I grew up with some personal philosophies not to go back and say, what would you have done differently? Or how could the world have turned out if you had done something? Could you have done it better? Because you're always looking at things saying, whoa, I didn't do it as well as I should have. And that's a frown, and my formula for happiness excludes frowns. So I don't ever look back. I actually had a good mind.
Can you tell the audience about the formula?
I had a good mind thinking out everything I was doing. And you see, I was the lone inventor. I was not an engineer, I was an inventor coming up with ideas, building project after project after project, not just the ones you see in Apple. And to me, every one of those was kind of learning experience, try to do the best job in the world better than other engineers would do. And so I was there. Now I had this computer. The Apple II computer, I totally owned it. I had done every bit of hardware, software, everything in it, all the design and thinking. A couple of friends had given good suggestions. And so Steve Jobs came in later and saw it and said, we should start a company and sell it. It's worth big money. It's going to make something big. But so I couldn't give myself advice like, you should have been doing something different, Steve. You should have also been looking for business and marketing. No, I let other people do that. I was just sort of a sole inventor type person.
You briefly talked about your happiness formula. Can you tell the audience here?
Yeah. Your personality settles between ages 18 and 23. Almost got my degree in psychology. Very close. But your personality settles, and that's sort of the person you are for life. And if you can tell yourself, here's how I want to be, here are my reasons, my core values, I'm not going to let them change throughout my life, you can hold on. So around 20 years old, I thought out, you know, between 18 and 22, I thought out, the college at your age is actually, I was thinking out, what should you do to be a good person? How do you do things? What is right? And honesty is the most important thing. But I read an article one day, I think it was about Sumner Redstone, a famous guy with Viacom and other, you know, media channels. And he was doing business, it was all about all these business deals and acquisitions and this and that. And I thought, wait a minute, if I were to die tomorrow, and I were that person that had arranged all this huge business stuff, or I was the person that died tomorrow and I was laughing with my friends about jokes and pranks, I'd rather be the one who was laughing. So I came up with a formula that happiness was the most important thing in life, not success, not by other people's measurement, not achievements, happiness. And my formula was how you feel emotionally. Happiness equals smiles minus frowns. And smiles, I'm going to do a lot of joking, I'm going to enjoy comedy, I'm going to enjoy music, I'm going to just have a fun time and smile a lot in life. But frowns is where I really had a key. Don't argue, don't care if other people think differently than you, don't pay attention. You don't ever have to convince anyone in an argument except yourself. You believe in how you think. And that way you avoid a lot of frowns. Just don't get mad. If your car gets scratched, just say, hey, cars get scratched or dented. You know, if they get dented, you know, move on progressively, find the way to fix it. Don't look back and have the sadness. And to this day, I've been so good at that, except that I get very angry when technology lets me down. And I think I did the right thing. I think I did the right thing, or it's a navigation program, and I turn to the wrong place. I hate it because it's people like me that didn't make it work really a human.
I love the formula, H equals S minus F.
Yeah, and I changed the formula slightly.
Oh, you did?
I didn't change it. I came up with another formula after I put on some big rock concerts selling a million tickets each year of 82 and 83, long before Bonnaroo and Coachella, the ones you hear about now. I was in Southern California, and well, I don't know, Steve Jobs felt I was more of a computer person, shouldn't be in this entertainment world, and I changed my formula. I happiness equals, of course, you have to have the necessities of life, clothing, a home, you know, food. You got to have that first, and then second, you got to have entertainment, and secondly, you need friends. Without people to talk to and this and that, you don't have a life. So my formula became H equals F cubed. Happiness equals food, the necessities of life, that's just the paradox, fun, and friends. Food, fun, and friends. But when I was being inducted into my high school Hall of Fame, the kids started laughing, and I had to go into the microphone real embarrassed. I said, well, there might be a fourth F.
But talking about technology was, do you think going forward, technology will start changing humans, or will help humans do things better? Everybody's asking.
That question is so open, it has no easy answer. You could take it into, are technology going to be embedded in humans to make them better? I mean, we already have fillings in our teeth to make us better, you know? Where do you call technology? Or are we going to do, after singularity was, where you can take your, if you could map your memories and put them in a machine, the machine lives consciously as you or preserves them for the future, and all that artificial intelligence stuff, I don't buy it. There was a time, singularity, my entire life, I watched technology versus human. The human should always be more important. We should put all the work into our technology to make it work in natural human ways that humans are used to working. We shouldn't force them to change their modes of behavior very much. And I see too much of that happening from all the companies, even Apple. And today, but you shouldn't have to, and you put the work in, so that the human should always be more important. We should not modify our ways, that makes it, to do things the technology way, it makes the technology more important. I also, always, all my life, I considered artificial intelligence. Can a machine equal the brain? From when I was in high school and wrote my first computer program to play a game of chess, a knight's tour of chess, and I realized at the end, my program would work, but it would get every answer in 10 to the 27th years. Longer than the universe has been here. A computer that can do things very fast, a million times a second, a billion times a second, a trillion times a second, still can't equal the intuition of how to solve a problem. We still don't have a single, we've never talked about artificial intelligence to this day of saying, what should I do today? I'm artificially intelligent, or what is a different approach that might solve the problem rather than just brute force, you know, look at 80,000 pictures of dogs and now I can tell what a dog is when a one-year-old child looks at it, gets told that's a dog and knows what a dog is for the rest of their life. You know, so I think the brain is so much different than what we call artificial intelligence. I used to ride my bicycle to Stanford Artificial Intelligence Research Laboratory, SAIL. I used to ride my bike there and they had machines that could pick up a red ball and put it in a red box real slowly. And they called that intelligence, you know? And then machines could eventually win chess and call it intelligence. Well, it's not like the human brain. We always keep raising the standard. And now they can play Go, but it's not like real intelligence and real thinking. Because like I said, the computer doesn't sit down and say, on a whim, what should I do today? It's not self-directed. And why does it need 80,000 pictures of a dog when a child only needs one and then won't even confuse a dog with a horse from then on?
Good. I think it's time for the Ferrari. What do you think, Wes?
All right.
All right.
The key.
Go. Key. It's a green and gold, so we'll see. The Ferrari is red.
I have one. Is this a question?
Yes,
I don't know what these
question.
Are.
Oh. And the person who wrote the question will have the key to the Ferrari.
What's one piece of advice you would give to college students? Okay, college students these days very much are paying attention to a lot of the young people that had successes starting with personal computers. Bill Gates and Paul Allen starting Microsoft and Steve Jobs and myself starting Apple and, you know, Mark Zuckerberg coming out of college and their movies were in movies about these things. So college kids are thinking, wow, it'd be so neat to be in one of these startups. But you have to realize, when you're first out of college, what's the most important thing in your life? It's getting a life. You're really being trained not in academics as much as you are how to live your life from here on. You should be taught how to live it very well and be a good person. But you get out, the first thing you're going to need is enough money, a salary, to have an apartment. And you're going to need, and then that's a good holding place, like college. If you have some ideas how I might change the future, I might be able to make an app that never existed, well, you can keep going on your inner passion, but at least get your income going first. Sitting in college and thinking out plans in your spare time rather than wasting them away and partying every night, same thing when you're out of college. Get your first job, you're young, you don't have to go out every night and party with young friends. Think about your ideas and help develop them in that free time. Within a few years, you might develop something so incredible, you've got the rest of your life made. One thing is, if you ever want to start a startup, there are cases you have a chance to be in something and you really believe it will go. And you know, a lot of good things that help people don't go. A lot of startups don't actually succeed and make it. But if you want to, it's a great thing to join one. It'll be the most fun time in your life, except for your 4 years in college. And you'll never forget it. And I often advise people, yeah, go with a startup. Sometimes even some of us, you know, dropped out of school because we knew we were onto something so exciting. It's got to be that exciting, and the purpose should never be, this is how I'm going to make a lot of money. The purpose should be, this is how I'm going to show my talents and help change the world and make something different than it is today. Be careful. If you start a company, a lot of people come out with business thinking. I will think of a plan. I know how to write spreadsheets and make company plans and write a business plan, and here's my idea, and then I'll go sell it. Because it can't really go anywhere unless you make money and have a company. And I'll look for investments, and then after I get the investments, I'll hire some engineers in some country of the world, and they'll build it for me. No, don't think that way. You need business people that want a company that will survive, marketing that knows it's a really good product, that people really will want it, and it probably will make money. You have a good sense of that if you want it for yourself, but you need the engineering. Thinking out your starting of a company, you should have an engineer, and not just somebody who graduated in the courses of engineering, somebody who has built projects, a lot of projects in their life, hardware, software, those builders are the ones that know how to get to the conclusion and finish things, even if they've never gone to college a day in their life. The guy who designed our Macintosh computer had learned his design talents, gotten as good as I was at hardware design, and he never went to college a day in his life. So you know, if you study, if you're motivated to do something, that's more important than knowledge, wanting to do something. So have that engineer in your group when you're thinking out a startup company early on. Try to build a prototype, a working prototype, even if it's not complete or functional, or if just virtual on a screen of how things will work, that you can show to people, and it'll be a lot easier to raise your money if you want to do a startup.
I like your advice to finish the degree first and then start thinking.
Well,
and you know, USF is number one university in the country in student success. We graduate students on time better than any other universities, and we place them better than any other.
I applaud that. And yeah, right. I was a good student. I would win the math awards in my schools, you know, a top student, and I was always good in college. And after 2 years of college, I took a year off and programmed computers to earn the money so I wouldn't burden my parents with the cost of the four-year college. Went to my third year, and then I took 1 year off to earn the money for my fourth year. And in that working year, my career went up and up and up, and Hewlett Packard and Apple and everything else. 10 years downstream. 10 years downstream, I didn't have a college degree, but I was 1 year away. And I had an airplane crash. I came out of amnesia after 5 weeks. I called up Steve Jobs and said, the Macintosh team is in good shape without me, and this is my last chance to go back to school, get a college degree so I can tell my own children I went to a college. And my name was famous, so I used a fake name at Berkeley, and my Berkeley diploma reads Rocky Raccoon Clark. That was my name. And so I got it, but I was the one who went back and got a real degree because I felt that was so important. And but you can balance it. Even if you get involved with a startup, you can always go back to school too.
Would Rocky Raccoon be interested in an MBA at the MoMA College of Business? I have the admission paper right here. We can do it. We have online courses too, so we can commute.
I would love to do that if I didn't have such
a
busy
done.
Life.
You're in. Balaji.
You know, very quick Apple question. You know, yes. Question about Apple's culture. And Apple's known for its culture. You know, what did it do to preserve it over rapid periods of growth? And then looking at it from the inside, did you see the culture the same way as the rest of us did? Now, looking at the
I'm not sure. The question is something about Apple culture because it echoes in here.
Okay. No, the Apple is known for its culture. And yeah. How did the company preserve the culture through rapid periods of growth?
Well, you kind of have a culture that when you start up with very young people that have never been in business, you kind of have a culture. We also started with great products. To this day, you could look at Google and Facebook and Amazon. They make all their money off of knowing everything about you. And Apple makes its money still off of good products. You know, so... you know, so we that's just our point in time, try to make things that are easy. We got a reputation early on for making computing easier than anyone else because our mouse-based approach was so much human. You could look at a screen and figure out how to do things rather than memorizing a ton of commands and being a computer geek. So, and that's very important to me. And that the culture of doing things, you know, as well as you can and not leaving holes, not letting people down, and always being trustable as a company still remains at Apple very much. And, you know, we also incorporated a lot of, Steve Jobs didn't know about computers. So we had computer people. At first, we were a computer company. We are not a computer company today. Not really. We kind of let that slide way down. But Steve Jobs was into the things that, you know, in his experience, in his travels, beauty and shapes of things, and you can admire a certain piano for how it sounds or the shapes of things and how it looks. So a lot of the design styling and just how things look to the eye turned out to be extremely important in the Apple world. And we mixed the two. You know, a very smart person can make something functional and form. And if you're not that smart, then you can make it very good form or you can make it very good functional. But
good. Was one of the topic and issues that is on everybody's mind, a lot of people talking about net neutrality. Net neutrality now is being questioned.
Yes.
How do you see the future of us using internet without oversight from the government that will make sure that the internet is neutral?
Net neutrality. Part of my philosophies that I developed when I was 20 years old, time of Vietnam War, Pentagon Papers book, I decided not to be political, to never vote for president. I don't believe in it. I'll vote for somebody who cannot win, but not somebody who can win. And so I want to get politics out of my life because then you're always getting things that make you frown. You know, there's always negative sides of it. Now, net neutrality, I was always for equality among types of people. I do not like big wealth separation that we have in the United States compared to Europe and Canada and Australia. I just always want to be like regular people. I always wanted to be in the middle myself. And this idea of net neutrality, it's a fairness thing. Anybody can kind of publish equally. When the internet first came, that's how we viewed it. That's what it was intended to be by people like Tim Berners-Lee, who brought the website of the internet to us. And now it's being converted and where countries get control as they can, what you can and cannot access. And then ISPs, if they're going to say, oh, you pay me some money, you get to come through. Well, that's just big business has more control. Look at Google. You do a Google search. You do a Google search, and people have paid to be higher up in the listings, in the responses that you get. Well, that's the same thing as non-neutrality, you know. So two times in my life ever have I flown to Washington, D.C. for something that was political. Two times. I flew the two times and sat in the FCC meetings when they voted for net neutrality. Those two times. and I believe in it very strongly that, you know, putting this, those who have money can control things so that they make more money. I just don't like that way.
Now, yes, that was very good. Unfortunately, we only have one Ferrari, but we have a Tesla. So
oh,
this is for the Tesla.
Lucky, lucky. Lucky, lucky. Question is, how do you deal with failure? Funny thing, I look back. I was in a 10-year period of magic pouring out of my brain. When I look back, I say, how do you do that? I'm not smart now like I was then. How did I think of those things that were so different and never been done that way before? And every project I worked on for Apple and anyone else was an A-plus solution. I never once had what you'd call a failure back then. In startups since then, I did have a failure where I had an idea for a great product, but it had to meet certain price, speed, and battery life numbers that didn't make. The way I look at failure is every project I ever did in my life that was for fun, building a little game, building a little sound maker. You know, back in high school, we had driving simulators, and I'd make something that sounded like a police siren to fool everybody in the dark. Well, but every one of those projects, I learned a few little techniques of connecting things together, and over time, I wanted to make them fewer and fewer parts than any other human would think of doing. But they were each, they weren't worth money, they weren't worth successful companies, but each time my brain improved and remembered it for the next project I did. You move forward, just like with mathematics. You start with one level of mathematics and move up through the levels. So those were kind of like steps on the way. They weren't real failures. Actually, you know, almost everything that I've taken on, get an idea so clear in my head before I jump into it that I have a pretty good idea that I'll be able to complete it and make it work. I did take on one project, just an amazing, amazing example of motivation. We were a year into Apple. All of our programs were on little cassette tapes. You'd have to read them in. It was horrible. You couldn't say, run a program. You couldn't click on an icon. And disks, if you had disks, you could do that. The college computers, you could do that. And I had never worked with disk hardware or software in my life, but Apple was going to be allowed into Las Vegas, the Consumer Electronics Show, along with Radio Shack and Commodore, to show off their computers. And we were going to go to Las Vegas, and I'd always wanted to see Las Vegas, the city of dreams, but only three marketing people were going to go from Apple. And I'm too shy to say, I'm a founder, take me. I would never demand that. So I raised my hand and I said, if we have a floppy disk, can we show it? I'd never worked with a disk in my life, and the show was 2 weeks away. Mike Marklar, our marketing guy, said yes. And now I knew in the back of my head, if I can work for 2 weeks and develop this man-year project that gets a whole floppy disk where you can say, run a program, run checkbook, and it runs the checkbook program, they have to take me to Vegas. I'd be the only one who knew how it worked. And I worked every day, Christmas Day, I worked New Year's Day, every single day, and got to the show, took a high school programmer with me, taught him how to play craps, and Randy Wigginton won $35. And I taught Steve Jobs how to play craps on that trip. We showed off that disc, and it was eight little $1 chips, and all the other designs had 50 chips, including a big, huge, expensive, you know, $20 to $30 chip. And why was mine so, it was just so unique. I thought of a different architecture, but I got to a point where I didn't know when I wrote the date on the disc and it came back, how would I tell where the bytes start and stop? You got 10101110, where are the start and stop points? Every eight of those little ones and zeros, and I didn't know if it was possible, but hit on magic and it worked. I found out later in life, sometimes you take on the impossible, you solve it, and sometimes you take on the impossible, and it really is impossible.
All right, Twitter question. Yes.
So there was this really old cartoon of a child asking a dad for advice, saying, Dad, why are these old pictures black and white? And the dad says, the world was black and white back then. But, you know, kind of related to that, a question is, in today's world, kids have information at their fingertips, right? Anything they want is right here instantly. So in that kind of a world, how do you teach kids to be creative of trying things on their own and failing when within a second you get what you want to know?
It's very funny. We talk about often, very often, about our computer technology. The modern digitalization of the world is how it's changed so much, and it's so important. Every company wants to make things digital, which means learning how to program. But the funny thing is, look at the STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, math. You go into a math test, and there's a whole bunch of multiple choice questions, and the right answer is the same answer for everyone else. And they all read the same book. Is that creative? Are you making something out of nothing? No, you're just memorizing and being able to answer the questions the right way. It's not very creative. Somebody who writes an essay, every person writes a different essay than someone else. Each one of them created their own version. That's much more creative. So the arts in general, are actually much more creative, being able to make up things out of nothing, even being able to make out a joke of something you heard. So so what was it that we were on the STEM subjects?
No, I think you answered it really well.
Yes.
But you know, a serious question, you know, that came up on, you know, the privacy versus national security trade-off. You know, Apple turned down the FBI request to access personal phone records in one case. What are your thoughts on privacy rights of people versus national security? I know you've...
Great question.
Yeah, and I stood with Apple on that, and I think most people probably did not. You know, I don't have anything to hide, you know. And, well, hey, if everybody had a little camera looking in on you 24/7, you do have things to hide. But but I put it into the category of the human or the technology, what's more important. And the technology at first made us very free, and now the technology is going to be so restricted and being watched all the time, the police state. I'm one of the founders of the EFF. There were four of us, and I was on the first board of the EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation, that fights battles for civil liberties and rights and privacy and things. And you know what? I can go in a room in my house and whisper, we can have private conversations, and they're private. And it's less and less and less that we even have that. Our TV might be listening. Our Amazon Echo might be listening. So so I kind of oppose that. It goes away from what humanness was in the past, but you can't change. That's the future. That's where we are. So we need some really good protective ways to, you know, A, obviously, solve some crimes. You know, the case with the FBI and Apple, they had all the information they wanted. There was nothing possible on the phone that could be anything than verifying what they already knew. So that was a very, very weak case. It was a lame case of it. But there are might be some real cases where, oh, you could get onto some more, I don't know, hidden terrorist cells or something like that. And there are a lot of ways to do investigation. This is just, that's only one of them. So I still stand up for Apple making things, giving me a product that I think is private, it should be private. I'm the buyer. The consumer should rule.
I like that.
Very good.
We have several serial entrepreneurs in the audience, and we have several students and recent grads who aspire to be entrepreneurs and wanna be the was one day. However, they are always fighting with this dilemma. You have a startup, and that startup, you know, you try to persist and work hard on that startup, but there is a time where you have to pull the plug, because just it's not gonna work. However, if you pull the plug a little bit early, you might be missing on a technology that will completely change the world, like the Macintosh. So what are your advice for these people on when to persist and when to know, hey, it's time to quit?
Well, are you persisting just to have a startup to be successful, or are you persisting because you're smart and you have some ideas and you have a brain that can think? And even if it doesn't seem that what you're coming up with works, you have a brain, you can think of another idea and do something else, or, and it's your passion is coming out. You'll never forget it. All the hours and the hard work you spent hoping something would go and it doesn't go, you still have the love of that life. That time in your life was so important and so fun to you, and you'll do it again. You're really learning techniques to be an entrepreneur. And there are a lot of cases, too, where entrepreneurship goes right away. You know, I mean, that's sort of what the Silicon Valley area is all about now.
You know, when you were with Steve Jobs working on this Macintosh in the early days, was it a single point in time where you knew that computer will have the biggest, most profound impact on how we do business, how we communicate, how we do, how we go by our lives?
Every change, every new technology gives me that feeling, you know, from personal computers to obviously, you know, mouse-based computers to laptops to internet came to, there were all these steps that were all that important. With the Macintosh, which you referred to, yeah, was when we went to Xerox Park Center and we saw this, how a little cursor on a screen could be used. It's not as direct as pointing at something with your own finger. That's really human. If I point to something and move it with my hand, that's normal. But this was remote control. A mouse would control it. Little words would suggest things of how to solve problems. An icon that looked like a paintbrush would actually turn your cursor into a paintbrush. I mean, these were human concepts, you didn't have to study and learn computers like experts like me would do and know everything about them. I walked out of Xerox Park Center realizing once you had that technology, it was a one-way door. You would never go back to what you had before, memorizing every little detail to type things in. It's just, it's harder. It's just a harder life.
But how about the negative impact of technology that we're seeing today? People don't talk to each other anymore. Social isolations, depression, lack of communication, basic communication skills.
Yeah, who talks about that? Mostly it's people from older generation. When I was very young, my dad said engineers create new things, and when you have new things, there's pluses and there's also minuses. And I decided that there's something in us that inspires us to create, to discover, explore, like science, and it's in us and for a reason. And therefore, change, when you have change, it's just a new world. It's different. It's not bad. You lost some of the bad things of the past, some of the good things of the past. Conversations with the people right around you was the way we lived our life, or at the dinner table. We had newspapers where I could quickly spot things in a very wide format. And we sometimes lose some good things, but that doesn't mean that what came is any worse. It's what the new generation gets very skilled at and uses, and they get the same, I think, mental benefits from it. So I decided when I was young to always say that change is good, because why are we humans driven to do it? You know, we're driven by nature, driven by evolution, we're driven by God, whatever. We're driven to do it. It's in us, so it must be the right thing. So I just say it's different and it's still good. It's just a different world. You have to understand that. Steve Jobs and I started Apple wanting to make the world more equal for handicapped people, for like a blind person and a sighted person to be much more equal. And we totally succeeded, because everywhere you go now, you look on the sidewalk and everybody's looking down at their phones.
That's a very good one.
There was a question related to this. There was a question related to this. You know, what's the obligation or the role of companies and technologists, you know, programmers, when you think of the negative possible consequences of the technology that they produce? Because just last week, for instance, many of the top universities are offering, now announcing courses in ethics for programmers and technologists. What's your thought on that? I mean, should you be aware that the thing you're creating can be used in unintended consequences that can, you know, cause damage to society? Is it the developer's role? What do you feel about
it? I feel it a little bit because I come from an older generation, but I don't think of it that way. I think that it is actually a good move, and it's just into the future, and it'll become the status quo. And you know what? As culture changes over time, it changes in a gradual enough way you don't really feel that, oh my gosh, we want to go back to the caveman days. We want to go back to the forest. You know, a lot of people that work in Silicon Valley, they have these country life dreams, you know. But it's just, it doesn't make something bad that you're using. I don't see that it changes you and your person, how you work with. Look at the shy person. Shy person would be scared to talk to anybody at school, in class, you know, be afraid and not socialize. And now they get a computer and they're in a room and they're anonymous. This happened even 20, 30 years ago. And they could actually get online and meet other people that were like themselves. They can stare into a phone and be communicating with people who think like themselves, even if they've never met, if they're anywhere in the world. I think of that as a benefit socially, whereas most people might say, well, you're not socializing the same way, right, talking to the people that are right next to you. Well, the people right next to you might not be the right best friends in the world for you.
All right. Oz, we have one last question from the fishbone. And since you advised students to finish their college degree and have an apartment, so the winner will have the key to an apartment.
Here we go.
The question is,
why did you name your company Apple? When we started, there was no idea that this business would be important financially. And when you're just young, you can pick up any name you think of. Now, Steve Jobs came back to me. I picked him up at the San Francisco airport, and as we're driving to our homes, he said, I got a great name for the company, Apple Computer. And the first thing I said was, what about Apple Records, the most famous record company in the world back then, the Beatles record company? And he said, well, they're a record company, we're a computer company. I said, that's all it takes? Younger Steve Jobs says, yeah. Oh, okay. It's funny because we did lose lawsuits to the Beatles for hundreds of millions of dollars, and then more hundreds of millions of dollars we lost to the lawyers that we sued for losing the lawsuit. But last day of Dancing with the Stars, a doctor who had treated a serious hamstring wound I had sat down next to me, and he said that his brother lived on that commune up in Oregon with Steve Jobs, and it was his brother who had gone up to Steve and said, I got a great name for your company. We did have to fight for the name. Once we had an investment, the Apple II was worth some big money coming in. We got the big money investment. We hired an agency to represent us, advertise it, and that sort of thing. And they said, Apple's not a good name for a computer company. It doesn't suggest lots of computation and calculations and work. And Steve and I said, no, Apple is a real positive name in the home. And an apple a day, and keeps the doctor away, and apple for the teacher. So we said, where our computers are going in the future, this is a good name, and so we held on.
Thank you, Oz. Before we finish, we have a very important order of business. This is the minute that you're all waiting for. This is the moment where we're gonna make history, and we will give the Oz, we will declare you today, the 2018 MUMA College of Business thought leader. And to help me, yes.
Oh my God. Hey.
And to help me give the award, two very special people that are so special that we say we named them after our college, Les and Pam MUMA. Please join me.
Great honor to meet you both. I was a technologist more than a business person, but I'd like to give you my metal business cards, which after 9/11, when they had plastic knives on the airplanes that would break on the steaks, these cards would slice the steaks real nice.
So. See, I told you he's a genius.
Let me make a couple of comments here. First of all, let me just say that the relationship Pam and I have with this university, in particular this business school, is wonderful. We enjoy every minute of it. The business school, the investment that we made in this business school back about three plus years ago, is the best philanthropic investment we've ever made. We would not be here today with this gentleman with us if it were not for that investment and the other investments that came after that. I would say that if we could have handpicked the initial inaugural speaker for this particular award, it would be you. You are, I was in the technology business and I was Microsoft and I was IBM, and then this crazy guy with Apple starts coming out with a product. And we watched it close, and I have to admit, Steve, I just converted to Apple on my desk at home within the past month. I'm a fool, I've bit off the Apple. But we appreciate very much what you've done, and I think my wife has a gift to give you.
Thank you.
Well, on behalf of the MUMA College of Business, Les and I really want to thank you for being here, for the wonderful presentation, how inspiring it was today. And we have a little gift. You are, as we've said before, our first inaugural MUMA Thought Leadership. And the bull is our, Rocky the Bull, is our logo, and we want to present you with this clock, and it says Thought Leadership Award, Steve Wozniak. Thank you so much.
The bull is to us what Apple is to you.
And Steve, we'll give you the instruction. This is not like any bull you've ever received. Tonight, when you go home, you have to be in a room alone. You rub it 3 times, and you make a wish. Your wish will come true. Please join me. Yes. Thank you. And no, we're not done yet. You've seen these great volunteers with the T-shirt that you cannot buy anywhere, a very special edition of your very own T-shirt with your beautiful picture, and it says the 2018 MUMA Thought Leader. So,
wow, okay. If you need any more thought leaders, I'll help you get them.
All right. Let's take a picture together.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
They've got one good one out of all that.
Yes, thank you. And again, we want to be mindful of Oz's time and your time. On behalf of USF, of the MUMA College of Business, faculty, students, staff, we want to thank you all for being here. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. What did you think? Good? Let's give Oz a very, very warm welcome. Thank you.